Part of what propelled financial services were the profits gained from providing American households with artificial purchasing power. The loans that many took out to splurge on consumption or to restore income levels they could no longer attain from shrinking manufacturing or back-office wages. Financial firms in the credit business, and few major companies were not in it, generally marketed their credit cards through solicitations that held out low costs and instant gratification. By 2003, many were imposing fees and interest rates on unpaid balances that critics compared to loan sharking. These 19% and 25% interest charges might be a sweet spot on the ledgers, but anyone taking a larger perspective had cause for alarm. Historically, top world economic powers have found financialization a sign of late-stage debilitation, marked by excessive debt, great disparity between rich and poor, and unfolding economic decline. Financialization can be defined as a process whereby financial services, broadly construed, take over the dominant economic, cultural, and political role in a national economy. In his book, In Praise of Hard Industries, British journalist Eamon Fingleton deplores financialism as the increasing tendency by the financial sector to invent gratuitous work for itself that does nothing to address society's real needs, but simply creates jobs for financial professionals. My term describes only the broader cultural and national transformation. Ordinary citizens suffer most, but they usually lack the expertise to fully comprehend the changes underway. The thesis of Part 3 of this book is simple. This debt and credit revolution constitutes the third major peril hanging over the future of the United States. Debt has long been a tool of economic and political management. However, during its first century and a half, the American Republic confined serious borrowing bouts to meeting the demands of major wars, the Revolution, the Civil War, and World War I. The debt was often paid down quickly, sometimes abetting a major post-war economic contraction. Large-scale expansion of public debt was rare in peacetime. The U.S. shift to fiscal permissiveness came in two stages in the 20th century. In the 1930s, when the federal government accepted large-scale deficit spending in peacetime to fight the Great Depression, and then in the wake of World War II, when Washington decided against risking another post-war contraction. Instead, policymakers let most of the wartime inflation and debt expansion stand. Accepting a national debt that had risen to more than 100% of GDP seemed the lesser evil. Happily, that ratio fell rapidly. Prosperity expanded the economy, reducing debt's relative burden. Real problems held off until the late 1960s when President Lyndon Johnson accelerated federal spending to pay for both a widening war in Vietnam and pursuit of what he called the Great Society at home. The 60s were the first named go-go years, and White House economists, convinced that sophisticated new management could transcend the business cycle, shrugged off the guidelines of careful accountancy and bet that the country could afford guns and butter simultaneously. These plans miscarried, and in a hint of worse to come, the federal budget deficit in 1968 climbed to $25 billion, or 2.9% of GDP, the largest since 1946. Foreigners became distrustful, especially after the United States in 1971 stopped letting foreign central banks redeem dollars for gold, as they had long been allowed to do. Senior U.S. economic officials were thereafter obliged to seek the tolerance of international and domestic lenders for large U.S. budget deficits, creeping inflation, or a combination of both. Their forbearance allowed American voters and major business interests to sidestep some of the unpleasant choices, most notably tax increases or benefits cuts, forced on unluckier fiscally loose nations. By the 80s, Democrats opposed serious spending reductions, while Republicans wanted to cut rather than raise taxes, and deficits rose accordingly.